So welcome to Agribusiness Matters. My name is Venki Ramachandran. Agribusiness Matters is an endeavor to discover systems thinking in food and agriculture in an age of runaway climate change. Today, I'm excited to have Shelly Aronoff, co-founder and CEO of Innoplan. You know, when I look at the next generation of companies that are going to dominate in the agri-tech world, and the kind of companies that have a lot of interesting things going on about about the future of agriculture, I really can't stop thinking about Innoplan in that kind of realm, because I feel it's pioneering on a very interesting trajectory that's also very close to Indians for a lot of reasons, right? In India, there was a long before in the late 19th century, we had a scientist called Jagdish Chandra Bose, who pioneered the idea of how plants react to stress. And you know, if you really go back to his history, then he's one of the earliest scientists who talked about plants' response to stress. And you know, even today, while I was researching it, you know, this subject, it was very, has a very fascinating history. So in that way, I'm really excited how that old science has found a new kind of a variant in the way you know, we're looking at biosensors and building a biosensor platform. So with that, I'd love to you know, get you on board. Shelly, welcome to Agribusiness Matters.
Thank you for that nice introduction. That's lovely.
Great. See, I mean, I really been listening to a lot of your podcasts in the recent times when I was writing my analysis on Innoplan. So I'm going to sort of skip the formal introductory parts about Innoplan, because I think people who are listeners of Agribusiness Matters are already familiar with Innoplan, and have also, some of them have read my analysis and take as well. So I'm going to skip some of the introduction parts and also assume that people already have some sense of familiarity, so that we can go a little more deeper on aspects that are really exciting to me as an analyst who is looking at Innoplan growth and its trajectory, right? You know, in your focus and as a strategic focus, right, you have written, and I think we've had this conversation in the past also, that you said that your core business is going to be on traits and not on chemistry. I'm curious, when was the genesis of this thought really came in, and how did you decide that this is the approach that you would want to take Innoplan forward?
Yeah, I mean, so I think the even better way to position it is, we wanted to design traits and not data initially, and also not chemistry. But the reason I say that is because if you think about what the traits are about, they're actually about generating insights. We're tapping into the plant's reaction to stress in order to create through a trait a signal, an optical signal that we can see. But the reason is not to create the signal, right? It's not to generate the protein or create the optical signal. It's to leverage that information so that we can enable farmers to identify diseases or nutrient deficiencies early on in their fields and then act on them. And the big question then is, like, what is the thing that you're going to monetize? Is it the insights? Is it the traits? Is it the chemistry? And in general, our strategy has always revolved around, farmers don't pay for data. No one pays for data. You don't pay for data. I don't think so. You pay for products that are generated and are better for you and recommended for you based on data, right? So if you take the same mindset into agriculture, you can monetize on the seed technology, because that seed is now able to communicate and it's providing more value to farmers. Or in the same sense, you can monetize on chemistry, because the chemistry, if applied on disease plants early, is going to be more valuable to the farmer. But either way, the thing that the farmers are valuing is a better product that works better for them. And then the question was, what is the core product for Innoplan? It was pretty obvious to us that it has to be the seed technology. And the other thing we liked about seeds is, we like to think about it as, like, seed is the most important decision that farmers make, right? It's the most expensive decision, and it's also the most valuable. And they make that decision well in advance of even planting. And also, the moment they put the seed in the ground, that is when the most potential for the genetic success. And every day after that, all you're doing is protecting and nurturing and trying to get as much of that genetic potential. So it really is all about the seeds, and everything else to us is just ancillary.
Yeah, and I think you really I really like your point in terms of focusing on the genetic potential, right? I think, you know, once we look at the biotech approach, there is always a trade-off between the genetic potential and the yield potential. I mean, and the agronomic potential, what we call in terms of the practices and what we do on the ground, and making sure that the genetic potential translates into the yield and agronomic potential, right? So, you know, when I was looking at your Series A investment memo, there was this whole aspect of, you know, that your core learnings from farmers was, you know, they don't want to change their existing operations, right? And they also wanted it to be affordable. To me, that was very, very interesting, because so far, you know, any set of approach to selling seeds was also revolved around, you know, we're revolved around certain some of the practices and changes there, right? So I'm curious, could you delve a little bit more in terms of what was the customer insight that kind of gave you that aha momentum that, you know, we should try and not really change the existing set of operations?
Yeah, I mean, so I started really as an outsider into agriculture. And one of the first thing I did was started to spend a lot of time with farmers, and especially large farmers, because that's our target market. With soy and corn in the US and Brazil, just massive farms, right? And their feedback was so crystal clear. I don't think there was ever a moment where it wasn't clear what farmers wanted. But I can give you some of the fun stories. So the feedback was no changes to my operation, no additional work, scalable, affordable. And I would say, and they didn't say the last part, but it was also there, fully integrated. It needs to be easy to use, right? Now, again, let's think about all humans, including anyone in the Silicon Valley. That's what everyone wants. So I don't know why people assume that farmers should want other things. Like when have you ever seen a customer that says, I want something complicated. I want many steps for implementation. I want, you know, to change everything I do every day. Like, none of that makes sense. They're humans. They're running businesses. Those businesses happen to be really hard and demanding and physical. And this is what they need, right? But the few of the stories that are my favorites is are one. I remember I was in Australia. We're visiting this really large cotton farm, probably 50,000 hectares. And he was telling me that there was this startup that asked him for some data analysis. It was one of those like geospatial recommendation startups. I don't remember the name, for six tissue samples to be collected. And he told her, the CEO, he told her, it's not that I don't want to, it's that I have five people managing this entire operation and I really just don't have the time and I will never have the time. I mean, this is the reality, right? Is that there's so few people and there's so many things to do and there's just very little room for experimentation. The other favorite was when he told me, how many days do you think it would take me to fly a drone over my field once? And the answer was 18 days straight, once to cover the field. So all of those things were just, okay, what do farmers actually need? And that's how we developed the technology. Now, I'm not saying there's not going to be slight changes. Like, there are things we're recommending. For example, one of the premises within our plant is, today in the US, when farmers apply fungicides, they go out to the field in R3, the certain time of the growth season. Because if you have no other information, that's the most economical time from an agronomical perspective. But what we're seeing in the data is that diseases can start a lot in advance of that. And we will very likely recommend that they go and do a smaller application, but earlier in the season. That is a change in operations if they're not going out to do that. But it's a smaller change than replacing a piece of equipment or doing another step in their, you know, seed processing or collecting data or writing it down that they wouldn't otherwise do. So that's the way we think about it. It needs to be small changes and as integrated as possible into the solution that they already have.
Yeah, I mean, that's a very interesting aspect, right? In terms of, like, you know, you want to bring small changes and you want it to be integrated, which means you also have to take certain kind of trade-offs in terms of what your areas are going to be, right? And I think that's where the idea of a biosensor platform kind of fits in there. And what was very interesting to me also was, see, you know, as a builder, as a founders, One of the, you know, I mean, as somebody who's built products in the past, one of the questions I always look very closely is, what are the trade-offs are we making in building something new, right? And in that, in this case, what I'm observing is that there seems to be a certain trade-off between choosing what is happening to the plant vis-a-vis what is happening towards its microbiome, right? Because at one level, yes, you can argue that you can't see, you know, you there is not really much way to decouple the plant from its microbiome or its environment, right? But from the focus on from a biosensor platform approach, or also from building sentinel plots, what I'm seeing is that you're making a trade-off that that you will prioritize the plant over its microbiome. Could you maybe help us unpack in what ways are you looking at this trade-off?
So when this is how we view it. So one, ultimately, if you go back to the when you put the plants in the ground, that is when you're starting to capture that genetic potential, right? And then what happens is genetic potential for soybeans in the US is 200 bushels an acre. For corn, it's 600. Farmers get about a third of that. So the environment is going to impact that. And we have very little influence on a lot of things that happen in the environment. What we need to do is for the things that we can impact, because we can't impact weather, for example, right? Just the hugest one. But we can impact disease pressure or pest pressure or nutrients, things that we have the tools to work on. And for that, we focus on the plant's reaction, because in that sense, that's really the only thing that matters. The only thing you're trying to do is protect the plant or nurture the plant. And everything around it is there to do that, right? So obviously, in order to, for example, protect the plant, you need to have, ideally, you have a healthy environment, and then there's going to be less disease pressure. But in general, at the end of the day, what you're looking for is that plant reacting to a fungal pressure, for example? And what's nice about just focusing on the plant stress is that you can clean out a lot of things that otherwise would look like noise. So for example, there's a lot of beneficial fungus, and we want that. And that's great, because that will never trigger a signal, because the plant is not going to react to that as a stress. It actually likes that, right? But if it's reacting to it as a stress, or similarly, by the way, if there's a small amount of fungal pressure and the plant's not reacting, then it's probably too premature to go and do something, because it might be that there's going to be some weather conditions that completely eradicate the disease and you didn't have to do anything to start. So what you're looking for is the earliest time point when the plant is reacting to stress, and that you're going to get from the plant. Now, I'll add to that. I think that adding to the plant information, which is the number one thing that we want, soil data would be amazing, because, for example, if you have a deficiency in nitrogen, so this is the other example, if a plant doesn't have enough nitrogen and it's got stress, that is the most important thing that you want to know. Now, the second most important thing is there enough nitrogen in the soil and the plant's not able to take it, which means maybe you want a microbe, maybe the plant's disease, other things, or is there just a deficiency and you need to apply nitrogen? But that's secondary to the fact that the plant has a deficiency, because regardless of what's going on in the soil, if the plant is not stressed, then you can do nothing, right? Because it's not limiting yields. The issue with soil data is that I believe that the basic research to understand soil microbiome is probably 20 years behind being able to build any tools on top of it. And I feel very strongly about this. I know people are building platforms on top of soil data. I think it's like a house of cards, because the basic research has to happen first, and it cannot be funded by startups. It has to be funded by academia. We talk to a lot of academics about soil, and what we know is that soil is incredibly complex and that people know very little about it, and that we probably have a couple of decades before we're going to master that domain. And when we do, we should integrate that data as well, because it would make the system better.
Great. I think you really hit the nail on the head in terms of what is primary and secondary. I kind of agree with what you're saying here. But here's a, you know, here's a sort of a little bit of a pushback here, just to
make this please. Yeah, we don't have to agree.
if we really look at if you talk to any agronomist on the field, right? Fundamentally, in my field travels, and I'm not an agronomist, by the way. I'm more like an outsider like you, who's studying and who's very fascinated by this subject. When I talk to agronomists on the field, what I hear them is, it's always a dilemma. It's a conundrum between, like, let's say if a plant is affected, right? Irrespective of whether it's a soy or a corn or anything, right? It's the conundrum is it related to, is the ecology causing that stress to the plant, or is it the plant's physiological structure that's causing that, right? I mean, is it happening at a rhizosphere or at a phyllosphere, right? To get a little more technical and specific here. So that's always been the dilemma for agronomists in terms of, is it coming from the plant or is it the ecology? You know, in terms of what is causing. So I'm curious, in your case, how have you, what gives you the kind of sense in terms of, are you saying that because there is less science advance in the ecology and the microbiome side that makes you focus on the plant? Is that why there's more certainty? Is that why you're prioritizing the plant over the microbiome?
I guess what I'm saying is, at the end of the day, you're not cultivating the environment. You're cultivating the crop. The reason farmers are out there doing what they're doing is to create a harvest that's going to be successful. So I understand that a lot of things impact the harvest, meaning like whatever is going on in the environment has all the whatever secondary effects or maybe primary effects. But regardless of that, what matters is a plant feeling stress, because what that actually means, it means that it's diverting energy. What do we measure when we say we measure the plant's reaction to stress? We mean we're measuring the plant's diverting energy from growth to doing something else to protect itself. And what the agronomists are really trying to do is prevent that from happening, right? So if a plant is now, it doesn't matter what it is, but if it's fungus, if it's now diverting energy to protecting itself from fungus, obviously it's going to limit its yield potential because it should be doing something else. And what an agronomist wants is to resolve that problem. And he will very likely resolve that with fungicides, not with a better microbiome, just realistically, right? So I think if you think holistically about, we want to think about the environment as a whole, I completely agree. And I think there's no way that's not true. I'm just saying that it's also impossible to do that. What we can do is understand what plants need and treat that. And then as we collect that information, ideally have a better understanding of the entire ecology around the plant, which is a lot more complex than the plant is in that sense. And then maybe we'll develop better tools. And that's another question, right? Because, I mean, just keep in mind, right? If you have a fungal pressure, what are you going to do? 99% of the time, you're going to put a broad range fungicide. The tools are not that developed. The only thing that I would argue that's incredibly developed is the genetics of plants.
No, I agree. And also, it ties down to the point that we discussed earlier, right? Like, in terms of what I really, I'm very intrigued, piqued by what your also approach is that you're also being agnostic to any remedial action, right? And the kind of partnerships you've made in terms of from different players and different companies coming in to,
everyone needs to participate for this to work.
Yeah, from Groma to Griffin to all the other players who are coming into this. What I'm also very intrigued by your approach, as a sort of an evolution in some sense, right? Because traditionally, any sort of players who are focusing on crop protection or seed business have a particular choice of remedial action, right? Yeah. Either they say, like, you have to go for this approach and then you get the results, right? There's always a carrot that's placed in front of you and saying, if you want better yields, we want to, you do this, right?
Yeah.
But whereas what you're saying is almost, a sort of a reverse of what's that, right? That you're not saying that if you want this results, you have to do it. You are saying, I'm going to only give you the ability to monitor what's happening inside the plant, and I leave it to you what's the best action, right? I mean, I'm very interested to kind of delve into the implications of this approach, and especially its acceptance about, farmers and what are their reactions and questions around it.
Yeah, I mean, yes. So again, this was essentially a little bit circular, but first, one of our core beliefs is that you need diversity. And the best way to create diversity is start moving away from the system that we have, which is one size fits all. Like, we take an action, everything was set towards this homogeneous action because it made large scale farming possible. Like, Roundup Ready is the best example. You have the trait and then you apply Roundup and you kill everything and it's great. However, nature doesn't love it. So within a few years, it evolved and weights evolved. And in general, this is what nature does. And by the way, even the biological companies, so they make one microbe. Guess what? Right? It's the same thing. Nature loves diversity, and we're giving it one thing because as humans, it's easier for us to develop one thing. But it doesn't work that way. It's not the most optimal system. So I think the next iteration is now with smarter equipment, automation. To me, the next step that's coming in ag is we're going to still be able to manage at a large scale, but we can treat individual plants. And it's that that's going to enable us with easy treatments to bring in diverse actions. So that's kind of how we started with this. Now, from an actual why we did it this way is because, again, we're not a chemical company. So I think if Monsanto launched this trait, I've never actually said this because this is something I came up with, this idea recently talking to the team, but I think if they would have launched this trait in 1995, they would have matched the fungus trait with a fungicide. And that's it. And that would have been, there would have been a data package. It would have been on the label. They would have recommended to farmers that this is what you should use and nothing else. And the problem is we would have ended with resistant fungus very, very quickly. So what we're saying is let's bring several products and work with a few companies and make sure that there's a few companies developing a data package and showing how the chemistry works with the traits and then recommend that. And the farmers can choose their products based on whatever they like, whether it's a relationship we have, they have a retailer, or it's a relationship they have with the supplier of that product, or it's a preference that they have. It doesn't matter, right? But they have the products that they prefer. Similarly with biologicals, like if farmers want to use different kind of products that are not chemistries, those should be available to them, and that will create better actions, more diversity. So that's kind of the mindset. And what enables it is, I guess, the different steps, right? Because the thing about Roundup and Roundup Ready is that it was really a one-two approach. It was the protein that only created the resistance to that one chemistry. And now we're introducing something in the middle, this data aspect of it, where, yes, we're generating protein, but the protein is only there to create data. The data can then be generated into insights using, you know, everyone's favorite words, AI and machine learning and whatnot. And then you can give farmers different recommendations and not put them into one thing every single time.
Yeah, I mean, you know, now that you're talking about Monsanto, I'm kind of tempted to ask this question, right? In terms of, you know, I mean, it's a very interesting your sort of thought experiment of what would have Monsanto done in 1995 with the fungus trait, right? Which makes me wonder, at one level, you know, in your articles on Forbes, I saw that you do talk about the space getting more and more consolidated, right? So yeah. In 10 years down the line, do you see in a plant sort of leading that consolidation from a you know, agri big six kind of agri? I mean, would you be the, in let's say 15 years or 10 years down the line, being a part of that big six, or do you kind of foresee that we're already moving into a newer era of deconsolidation? Because at one level, you know, there is a lot of consolidation happening. So I'm curious, how do you see that future?
Yeah, that's a good question. I do think that the space is very consolidated. I think another thing that is an opportunity nowadays that just didn't exist 5 years ago or 10 years ago is that weirdly, it's getting more consolidated, meaning in the past, there are companies driving in their own lanes. Equipment manufacturers made equipment, agrochemicals made seeds and chemistries. The retailers sold fertilizers in spraying. And what's going on now is that they're actually, everyone's competing for the acre, the 1 acre. And how do you provide the most value to farmers through that acre? So in a sense, everyone's competing with each other. And it doesn't matter at this point who you are in the upstream value chain, you're actually competing with everyone else because you're going after the same dollars from farmers. And that created an opportunity because in a sense, it's less consolidated, more or less, however you want to think about it, because they're all competing with each other. There's more competition around the table. So that to me is the opening that's creating the opportunity. Now, how it's going to evolve, I just got this question actually a couple of weeks ago. I think the answer is that what breaks up consolidation is innovation. Like if you think about so many spaces, this has happened before, right? Communications is a perfect example. But this happens all the time. If you have a step change innovation, it actually breaks up a lot of the consolidation. And then what happens is that some of the traditional big businesses compete and innovate and participate and evolve and become greater, and some fade out and some new ones come in. And I do think that will happen. I think some of them are going to become greater even. And I think some of them are going to fade out. And I believe that it will open up opportunities for new companies to come up within this new system, because they'll be able to see the opportunity and act on it fast. So I suppose the answer in one sentence is that it's only with innovation that you can break up consolidation at this point.
Yeah. And I mean, that's where, I mean, at one level is communication. We did, you know, see that breakdown happen. And then now a newer set of consolidation happened in terms of the
every
funds.
Time, every
yeah,
time.
Every
yeah.
time. Yeah.
There's research about this, right? Apparently the stable state of industries for companies controlling 60% of the market. And if you look at it, someone was asking me, so ag is incredibly consolidated. I'm like, yeah, look, here's the thing. Everything's incredibly consolidated. Everything. You go into a supermarket, there's five companies selling you a bunch of stuff under many brand names.
Yeah.
There's just, this is how everything is. But every once in a while that breaks up, and it could happen because the government decides to step in and do something, or it could happen because there's such an innovation that shifts the way that people do things, and it does change the dynamics.
Yeah. Yeah, I think your point on government is also very interesting, right? Because, you know, it's been something I've written about also in my newsletters, in my Agribusiness Matters for a long time, in that somewhere antitrust mechanisms don't seem to really work in food and agriculture.
I agree.
Compared to
I think it's not
other
important
industries.
Enough. I honestly just think it's not important enough. It just doesn't garner enough attention. It's this weird industry where everyone loves thinking about it and talking about it, but then they just leave it the way it is. But actually, fresh off the press, I don't know if you saw this. This literally came out a few hours ago. The U.S. courts outlawed dicamba. The trial that happened in Arizona. So there is no more dicamba, which is incredible, like insane, to be honest, and pretty admirable. Because think about it, like where we are, we're recording this, it's February 6th. This means that there's, I think, 32 million acres of dicamba resistant seeds out there that were already purchased and are supposed to get planted. There's a ton of dicamba in the pipeline that was already purchased that needs to be sold for retail. What are you going to do with all that? And it's all unusable for at least 2024. So sometimes government does the right thing, you know?
Yeah, I mean, yeah, it's interesting. You know, coming back to Inoplan from a, and also from an advancements, right? In terms of, like you talked about the future in terms of innovations, really creating, breaking down certain consolidations and moving in. How do you see the advancements from a pipeline and from a horizon perspective? Do you kind of look at the sort of building the same technologies for, let's say, for, I mean, you did talk about in the past about inner soy and inner cotton. Are you looking at some of those aspects, or how are you envisioning this kind of infrastructure for the biosensor platform to go further?
Yeah, I mean, so we're very focused on one, soy, and second, corn. And with each one, we go after the stresses that are relevant to 95% of farmers and have a high economical threshold. That's the way we just choose what to do. So that's how we got to with fungus and insect for soybeans. And with corn, it's going to be fungus, insects, and nitrogen deficiency. Now, there's things that everyone should care about. And we also think about like phosphorus, but the reality is that farmers are not going to pay for phosphorus. It just works that way. Drought, right? If it's not a big, we like to think about it as a real and perceived problem, because it has to be both. It needs to be a real problem. It needs to be perceived as a problem for farmers. And if it is, then that's on our list. What happens after soy and corn? You know, honestly, for a very long time, we just worked on soy fungus. Now we're expanding to soy insects, and we started working on our corn platform, but we're very dedicated to being cost effective and focused. So I can't even tell you that I want to do anything beyond that, because I think it's already very aggressive. But if the day comes and you ask me what I want to do, cotton for sure, and then wheat and rice. crops that are actually not genetically engineered. Maybe one day, right? Once we, if we can accomplish this, if we can show the world that there's something that helps us just treat plants that need treatment and leave plants that are healthy alone and reduce the environmental impact and make farming more efficient and more sustainable, then I think there's an opportunity to expand into other kind of crops. What I personally don't like as much as small crops. I just don't like those opportunities. I don't think for a VC business it makes sense. But you know, maybe one day someone else can take those to market. It probably won't be me as a CEO, though. I'll be honest. My team knows that.
Very interesting, because I somehow assume that you would largely look at genetically engineered plants from the sense of building into the platform. But what you're saying is like you may also want to go beyond that also to and bring them onto your biosensor platform. That's very interesting.
Yeah. Well, first the things that are large and already genetically engineered, and then yeah, it, after that. But like I said, that's after soy and corn, so we've got time.
Yeah, I mean, very interesting. I mean, see, there's also, you know, if I were to really take a sort of a bear case analysis on Inoplant, right? You know, one of the interesting aspect that I when I look when I started looking at the bigger picture of what this kind of innovation means in the, you know, the in the larger sense of things, scheme of things, is that, you know, if you really look at you know, evolution's natural selection process, natural selection tends to favor ecosystems in many ways, and you know, and then even while it does work on an organisms also, I mean, and it's more pronounced in organisms, but you know, individual plants and growth, but it tends to less favor the ecosystems, right? So I'm curious, how do you see you know, from a sentinel plant's perspective, the ecosystems and approach there, right? Because at the end of the day, you know, when you're looking at building ecosystems of sentinel plants, there is going to be other sets of, you know, farming fields where they are not necessarily the sentinel plants, right? So, I mean, there are going to be multiple ecosystems that are going to look at, you know, I'm just looking at slightly forward gazing in the future in terms of when there are ecosystems sentinel plants and when there are ecosystems of non-sentinel plants, how do you see that kind of evolution really playing out, right? Because at the end of the day, natural selection is far more pronounced on organisms and more than the ecosystem at some level.
I mean, I just think it's a choice, I suppose. I mean, if farmers decide to plant crops that can't signal of their stress, then they're gonna have lesser results. But those plants, like any kind of plant that we produce, is not going to impact any plant around it, because it doesn't work that way. It's not like the plants actually breed with each other. Soybeans breed through. They're just there and they do what they do, which is generate data. And then the farmers that have them can act on them. I do think there is more philosophically, you could have information sharing between farmers if they choose to. So if you think about an ecosystem from a sense of, and then, you know, a group of farmers working around each other, if someone does have sentinel plants and they know that they have a fungal infestation, if they share that information with their neighbors, maybe they give them access to that for a fee or something, then those neighbors can act on that information as well. And that information will be relevant to them, because diseases, everything spreads in a certain pattern. But I also think that the more I do this, the more I believe there's just an incredible amount of variability. So even if you take 100-acre plots, I fully believe that there's diseases start in a small scale and they don't spread uniformly. And you shouldn't apply chemicals everywhere. You should apply only on infected areas. So I think eventually what will happen is farmers will want to have the information in every seed. They're going to want to act on it in the most optimal way. And the way adoption will happen is the easier it is to adopt, the more farmers will adopt it. Right. So the more everyone knows about it, it's fully integrated with the John Deere equipment and the products that they're buying, and the retailer knows how to use it and so on. That's how you get all the laggers to come on board. I don't know if I answered the question, but those plants are not gonna, they can't interact with any other plants. It doesn't work that way.
I understand. I think I did, you know, in my earlier conversation with Rod long back, we did talk about this, right? I mean, the technical term is a horizontal gene transfer in terms of how the, you know, the genes, I mean, in nature, nature doesn't rest, right? Nature loves to keep moving around and tinkering and continuously experimenting it. So that's where I was, the moment when I started looking at the bigger picture, I started exploring what kind of scenarios in which the entire evolution process of natural selection would play out in terms of selecting over a sentinel plants, which may be, let's say, you know, sharing its premise with another plant, which is non-sentient in some sense, right?
Yeah, but so this and, is, and, yeah. I get what you're saying. And this is actually something I remember in the early days, I was talking to Rod about it, my co-founder, and I'd ask him, so like, can the weeds, for example, evolve and make our protein? And it's impossible. Because there is no pathway. Like the thing about some of the traits that you see out there, like Roundup Ready, was one gene. You modified one gene. You knocked out one gene. So like the reality is that plants can fast understand that. And that's what weeds did. They're like, okay, they did enough, you know, billion of iterations. And they figured out that if I just don't have this thing, then I can't metabolize this chemical. And that's kind of the baseline of, if you make something that's simple, quote unquote, and connected directly to death, then nature will evolve. But the other part is, one, yes, it's going to be very improbable that they can start to learn how to make this fluorescent protein. But two is, we're using it as humans. See, this is the thing, right? Sometimes humans are pretty clever. We're using a signaling mechanism to communicate information, to analyze it, process it, and act on it. And nature cannot figure out all of those things together. Right. So if you compare, we dose everything with a chemical, nature's great at understanding, man, this chemical keeps coming. It's the same thing. So can I evolve? Right. That's the mechanisms that they evolve to. Whereas when you take all of these human steps in the middle and you create all this analysis, you're asking the plants to not really generate a signal. You're asking them to become sentient and figure out all of the other steps that got to eventually something happened to me. And that's very impossible, right?
Yeah, I mean, I understand that. I think that's where it's, I mean, that's the part where I'm really intrigued in terms of seeing this will really play out, right? Sorry?
Yeah, I never thought about it. Like the using plants to communicate is kind of making them sentient. Anyway,
yeah, I mean, I think, and that's the part I'm really intrigued in to see in some time, how would that in that kind of, you know, play will go out in terms of how would nature react to it and respond to it. And actually, in fact, I've been digging also into some studies that, you know, like people who've studied solar induced fluorescence, you know, the researchers, because solar induced fluorescence has been there for a long time, right?
Oh, so, absolutely.
Yeah.
Solar induced fluorescence is the baseline to some of the detection technology that we created, right? Because all plants fluoresce chlorophyll naturally.
Yeah. So, and I think that's when I'm very intrigued to see how this will play out. The last question I want to bring it up is, I mean, it's also connected to the previous question I asked you, right? I mean, in one level of looking at, you talked about how farmers could share the information between those who have a sentinel plant and those who don't.
And I don't know that they want to, by the way.
Yeah, I understand. I hear what you're saying.
Because it's a big share.
Yeah, I know. Yeah. No, I mean, the way where I'm getting at is, you know, in technological innovation, right? Just stepping aside a bit from outside agriculture, right? We have seen open sourcing of technologies, right? And that has always been, you know, I mean, I like to look at technology from a genesis to custom build to product to commodity, right? And oftentimes, when you move from a product to a commodity, there is always some kind of a shift that really makes it commoditizing it, right? And then that makes it like a default. Like today, I mean, I take it for granted the cloud and cloud infrastructure that's available because it's a commodity, right? And so, you know, when I really again look into the far horizon and look at in what kind of conditions this could become a commodity. And the answer to that for me is always, I mean, and let's take the case of, let's say for, you know, in small holding farms or in worldwide, right? It, something becomes a commodity when people are already start to open source the technology, right? So where I'm very, very interested to kind of explore is in what ways? I know, you know, I'm just talking in a very, very long horizon here, but in the longest horizon there, in what ways an open sourcing of this kind of a biosensor platform would really look like was another sort of hypothetical question I had in my mind.
I'm not gonna lie, we think about that all the time, because I don't know the answer, but we do play around with it. I think there's a scale to component, like you said. If we have 200 million acres of soybeans that are communicating this kind of information, that means that we have a really deep understanding of pathogen pressure and pest pressure, and we have learning abilities around diseases that we never had before. And you can think about that and the implications on food security, right? And predicting where there's going to be issues and where will we have a lower harvest, predicting commodity prices and how that's going to impact the world. So I think at a certain scale, it just becomes a thing that's just going to be important to a lot of people. And you can't keep that forever, you know, closed, I suppose. But it's so hard to say. Honestly, and it's so hard to say how you would even open source it to start. I do think about it a lot. It's an interesting question.
Yeah, and I think you know, I mean, that's a question I'm also really thinking a lot about, this aspect in terms of how would these kind of, because I'm kind of convinced, you know, if you look at a broad historical view of how technology eventually evolves, right? The way it evolves from being a product to a commodity where it scales in kind of nominal levels, right? Today, it only happens when some kind of an open sourcing happens or some other ways where in which things start to either become commoditized or componentized, where, you know, where it reaches scale. So yeah, I'm also kind of intrigued, you know, because at some level, for a technology like this to come down to other parts of the world, right? Let's say for India, right, where I'm right now speaking to you from.
Yeah.
In which case, some eventual commoditization has to happen in some ways where this can really scale at a very, very massive levels, per se.
I always think about it as the value. It's just some technologies are superior to others, right? Like in general. But then if you look at agriculture, and you look at the adoption of genetically engineered seeds, it is a superior technology. The reason that it doesn't go away is because the reality is that without better tools to replace the old tools, you can't take away those tools. Farmers cannot go back to farming without those tools. Now, I'm not going to say there's not going to be another evolution. I think See & Spray is a great example, the technology from John Deere for the alternative to herbicide tolerance. So it happens. It just has to happen first, and then you can get rid of the older technologies. So it's all about the value to farmers. And India is actually a super fascinating example because I don't know if you're familiar with this, but when genetically engineered seeds were introduced in India, the government didn't want to regulate them. And then someone actually went to the US and got a license from Monsanto and brought the seeds over, and farmers just adopted them regardless of regulation. And it caught like wildfire because it's technology that they wanted to use. And eventually the government
really
kind of
cotton
gave
growth
up.
In India because of that.
And eventually like the government gave up. And there's also numbers about this. If you probably know the numbers, it's a pretty fascinating story, right? But the reality is that if something it is very compelling from a value perspective, then it tends to get adopted and then probably to a commodity level, right?
And I think you know, we are in case of BT cotton, I think we have seen what has happened over time and in what ways it's played out, and there are a lot of aspects into it, and I think you know, that's a separate conversation for another day, but I think coming back to the sentinel plants, I think that what is really being attempted in terms of you know, in terms of the focusing on the plant and stress, and then also in terms of relying on, I mean, I really like your point about how the newer technologies has to come in to replace the old one, right? And I think that has a massive implication from a sustainability perspective. So I think that's where I'm seeing it also from the sense of, you know, if we were to maybe is the way to go against or probably the next evolution of herbicide tolerance, is it via a See & Spray, or what ways can we come down, right? Because at the end of the day, We are looking at cutting down the amount of pesticide use and also the abuse that has been happening for a long time.
But and by the way, it doesn't always happen that way. In Europe, they're just putting the regulation without the tools, and that's going to be painful. I'm not saying farmers are not going to do it. They will do it, but it's going to be painful, and yields will suffer, and their economics will suffer, and they're going to be very upset. And Europe is going to import more and more grain, and they're going to be even more upset. So the reality is you can do it that way. And my favorite example is the straws. Do you know the sustainable straws? I don't know what to call them. It's basically, there's regulation around plastic straws. So if you go to a cafe in San Francisco, you're going to get the alternative. And if you have a small child, then you know that it's useless. Like, they just go through like five of them because they don't know how to use them. They're just so bad. And that is one way to do it. But the better way would be, can we figure out a better straw? And what's fascinating to me is I get the logic, right? Like, first make the plastic straw illegal, and then the alternatives will come up faster. But they haven't, which is fascinating. Like, we've been waiting and the alternatives are not coming. So I don't know what's the deal. Maybe it's really hard to make a sustainable straw. Point being, it's even harder for a business. So hopefully we can deliver farmers the tools that they need in order to make the changes that they need, versus just force them to make the changes and not supply them the tools, because it's very painful for them as business owners and humans.
No, I mean, it's a dilemma between until what time do you want to change the demand side behaviors as opposed to supply side, right? When we work in business, we like to think about it from a supply side perspective, in terms of,
that's right, yeah.
Let's bring the new tools, and let's bring the newer tools that will replace the old tools and continue. And whereas the question is also from a demand side, in terms of, to what behaviors are have been ingrained because of certain, I mean, let's really look at it from a historical sense, right? Plastics have only been around for a very small period of time, historically, when you look at it from the bigger picture. Crazily.
No, it's amazing. I mean, the other thing is, the more I think about it, the more I just come to the conclusion, everything has been around for a very short time, right? Everything is the outcome of post-World War II. That's it, right?
So
in some ways, there's the fact that our food system that we take so insanely for granted now is incredibly young and vulnerable. And this is what, maybe the second generation that hasn't experienced hunger ever in humankind. And we just now act as if this has been around for thousands of years, and let's just like not tweak it, but just cut it all together and figure out how to rebuild it. And that's just not, I mean, fine, we can do that, but it's very risky because it's such a relatively new tool, and on the other side, I think that our diets, my God, the American diet can probably get a lot of, a facelift. And in reality, again, it's just been around for 50, 60, 70 years. So this assumption that people want to consume this much meat and dairy and will never be able to consume anything else. I mean, why? Why? It's been a blink in kind of the whole spread of time. And most of the time, humans have not consumed this much animal protein and dairy. So anyways, I do think some shifts are coming. They have to.
I think that's what, I think that makes the space really exciting. I mean, I'm very intrigued by what you pointed out, right? That many times we don't really pay attention to this space as much as, I mean, when you talked about the antitrust regulations, why they haven't really been there. And I think, that's one of the reasons why I talk about the food and the agribusiness aspects, because I think the implications of what we are building in, right, from a food systems perspective, have deep ramifications in terms of how we're looking at it. So,
But people don't want to know. And I don't know why. I think people just don't want to know where food comes from. I don't know if it's because of the romantic notion. They want to envision that it's something very different than the industrial farm. Or maybe I think it's actually because of animal protein. Because we got so used to not wanting to see where food comes from, because it's not something that we as humans can actually stomach, that we just decided to not want to know where food comes from altogether.
Yeah, and the alternative is we create some ideal nostalgia.
Yeah.
And we think
Old McDonald had a farm.
Sorry?
Seriously, Old McDonald had a farm. Because see it as a kid and you never see anything else, and you think that this is what farming is, and you never pay attention to the fact that you've never seen a farm like that. And where is all the food coming from, right? Like, as a child, you don't know that.
No, I mean, At many levels, I mean, it's again a question of the geography here, right? In India, we do see older
non-Islam. This is US Spain, so, for sure. Yeah. No, there's places where people are a lot more connected to their food and they're still small scale ag, right? For sure.
Yeah. And I think in that's where, you know, there is a, I mean, historically, if you look at the civilization, the society is moving in from, let's say, a feudal societies to modern societies to, you know, and in that, each of these societies are in the middle of transition. And that's also another exciting part for me to look at it is, you know, because typically whatever happens in, you know, in the US and in Europe markets have an imprint on what is going to impact in let's say, in Southeast Asia or in India. Right. So that's also another reason where this will get very.
But I think that's where we need to stop, though. I mean, we can, if we export technologies from the US to other places, that's amazing. If we export the lifestyles and cuisines, I don't think that's a good idea. If anything, it should be the other way around. Like India cuisine should be for sure. Like, and I hope that happens soon. To me, it became very clear recently that this Western diet is coming to an end and people are going to choose different paths soon. But I don't know that other people see it as clearly. So I don't know how long the transition will be. I just think that it's so unhealthy and people are going to want to find a different path soon. And obviously places like India have found it. There's like other places where food is more healthy for consumption. The diets, not the foods, the diets.
Yeah, and I think that some kind of reversal did happen, especially after pandemic, right? Because in pandemic stressed out the conventional food systems, people were forced to go back to their own traditional diets in many ways. And I think some shift did happen, but although now we did course correct and things have gotten back to a status quo in some sense. But yeah, I guess, you know, these are exciting times to see how these will play out and in what way these technologies will change.
Yeah. We're about to embark on another green revolution, I think by 2030. And then by 2040, we'll just be done. It's going to happen. It's exciting times.
Great. Yes, I think that's in that. I think thank you very, very much. We will look forward to see how these exciting times will play out. And I hope to chronicle that also. That's been my work in as an agri-tech analyst. And I'm very excited to in that ways, you know, that we could speak today. And it was a really lovely conversation. And I think there were a lot of interesting takeaways for me to mull over when I'm going to document this. So thank you very, very much for taking the time. I know it's quite late in the evening for you.
Thank you. This was great. This was really fun.
Great. Thank you so much.